recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. This week on Infamous Indie, an inside look at covering a national story from a reporter with years of experience. He's been doing it basically for a very long time, Richard Essex. He's currently a reporter at Witch TV here in Indianapolis, and I sat down with him to get his perspective on a bizarre case that happened in 2009. Originally, he's from Zionsville, Indiana. He went to Indiana University. Richard also worked in Lexington, Kentucky and Raleigh, North Carolina as an investigative reporter. But before those jobs, he worked for about a decade at WTHR in Indianapolis. And for anybody who's familiar with the TV space here in Indianapolis, WTHR is the number one station in the market, followed by Fox, Wish TV, WTTV, and then also RTV6 is mixed in there, whatever. The ones you need to worry about are WTHR and Wish TV. His first job was in radio in Orlando, Florida. He also made the jump to television in 1998 as a weekend weather anchor and reporter, which I didn't know until I started doing research on him for this episode. But ultimately, he is someone I consider a friend. In a very short time that I've known him, Richard is one of the best reporters I have ever met. Thorough, very pointative, and he just does the work properly. He sat down with me before his shift at Wish TV to give me his perspective on what it means to be a seasoned reporter covering crime on the daily news grind in Indianapolis. I had a few questions in mind for Richard before the interview, but when I talked to him a few days prior to interviewing him, I asked him what he would like to talk about, and he said, look up the case, Markish Shrinker. You guys want a crazy story? Well, here we go. In the mid-2000s, wealthy business owner and money manager Markish Shrinker lived a cushy life with his wife and three kids in a million-dollar home on the shores of Geist Reservoir in Indianapolis. Private jets, luxury cars, beautiful vacations, that was the norm for the Shrinker family. And as perfect as that life appeared, there was also a dark side, according to a couple of people who knew him. Shrinker would go from being like very friendly and charismatic to angry, unreasonable, combative. And according to his neighbor Tom Britt in an interview with abcnews.go.com, episodes of this type were very erratic and became more frequent as he grew older. Later, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Well, things changed very quickly in 2008. Shrinker was under investigation in Indiana after several complaints were lodged by some of his investors. They were upset with their handling of their money. His wife, Michelle, also filed for divorce on December 20th, 2008, after learning of her husband's infidelities with a woman who worked at the airport. So on January 6th, 2009, the scene is kind of set here for this date. Shrinker was charged with unlawful acts by a compensated advisor, an unlawful transaction by an investment advisor. So pretty much a basic bad thing for your financial advisor to be accused of. Bail was set at $4 million. So this is all going on. Things are starting to really spin downward around him. The world is crashing in, and Markish Shrinker did something that many of us think about we were doing, but probably would never actually accomplish. And that's run away from everything, or at least try to plan an escape. On Sunday, January 11th, 2009, just a few days after he was charged with those crimes, Shrinker went to Anderson, Indiana, and flew his single-engine Piper plane to Florida Panhandle. He was planning on heading down that way. As he neared Birmingham, Alabama, he put out a fake Mayday signal and told air traffic controllers that he had been badly injured and was quote-unquote bleeding profusely after the windshield of the plane imploded. After his call to air traffic control, he put the plane on autopilot and then got out of the plane, parachuted down to the ground. Military jets attempting to intercept the plane reported that the door was open, the cockpit was dark, and everything appeared to be pretty much fine, other than there was no pilot piloting the airplane. It ended up crashing about 200 miles later in a swamp in Santa Rosa County, Florida, 50 yards from a residential area. After the crash, the plane was found somewhat intact. Investigators were actually able to do some research and found that there was nothing wrong. There was no blood inside. The windshield was completely intact. And then they put a warrant out for Shrinker's arrest. Well, Shrinker denies that he was planning that. He denies in some articles and interviews that he wasn't actually planning to run away, but it didn't turn out how he thought it would. But the evidence is pretty damning. On that January 10th, the day before he parachuted out of his plane, he drove to Harpersville, Alabama, and stashed a motorcycle, money, and other supplies in a storage facility. He informed the owner of that facility that he'd be back. Shrinker parachuted to the ground. He made it to Alabama, where about 2:30 in the morning, he asked for help from someone nearby, and he told that resident that he had been in a canoeing accident. And so she gave him a ride to town and to a local police station. He gave the same story about the canoeing accident to police in Alabama and actually gave them his license. And police brought him to a hotel where he registered under a fake name and paid for cash for the room. And then the next morning, after hearing the plane had actually crashed and was that evidence was clear and strewn about, Shrinker went on the run. Police went to that hotel where they dropped him off, but he had already left. The manager there said that he rode off, and they didn't really know where. But based on evidence they found in the plane, which were torn out sheets of campground information, and it was a Florida campground info, that they were able to figure out that he was probably going to stay at a campground somewhere in Florida. So he went to a KOA campground in Quincy, Florida. He bought a tent site for one night, some wood, a six-pack of Bud Light Lime, and then was given access to the campground's wireless internet where he had his computer with him because that was part of his go bag, essentially, in that motorcycle. Well, this is where some of the groundwork that Richard will talk about comes into play. Well, Marcus was running around police, and you will soon hear Richard was working to find him. So the campground, let's just go over what happened. The campground owners were contacted by the sheriff, who wanted to know if there was anything unusual going on, and they told the sheriff about this guy who had come in the previous day but hadn't checked out. Soon afterwards, they swarmed the campground and found Shrinker barely conscious. He was lying inside the tent because he essentially cut himself to try to kill himself. He had lost a lot of blood. And he was then flown to the Tallahassee Memorial Hospital. On January 13th, Shrinker was arrested and charged in federal court in Pensacola, Florida, with deliberately crashing his plane and making a fake distress call. The story made national headlines. Even Jon Stewart covered it in his witty style, as we all like it. Go online and check that part out. It's hilarious. But when it comes to being a reporter in a town like Indianapolis, and you have a story like this, you literally have to be ready for anything. Nowadays, people don't, or reporters and stations, don't do this as much. Richard was picked to basically go on a trip, fly to Florida and Alabama, where all this was happening because it involved a former, an Indiana resident who had left the state. So he went with his crew, and it's just essentially him and a photographer, into another state to cover a story for Indiana. And you'll hear his perspective, and we talk about the case from his perspective, and then we also talk about a much bigger issue that's becoming more prevalent, but is a perfect time to bring up with someone like Richard. We're talking about, in the podcasting world, that is, citing your sources, and why that's important, and why that's important for not only the integrity of your own work, but more importantly, making sure that the industry as a whole doesn't get a bad name because all of a sudden, you know, a top podcast isn't citing their sources, and then they're asking everybody to pay for it. We shall not talk about that podcast any longer. Point being, you can go on my website and check out all my sources directly for free. Because that's what reporters do. You should definitely, I can put my own opinion in this beginning part, but really the facts that you were hearing are from different websites that I look up, and I know this story from Richard and from around the newsroom. So
hey everybody, welcome back to the Infamous Indie Podcast. Another interview today with an expert of sorts. In fact, he's been around in the business of telling stories and, more importantly, investigating crime for how many years, Richard?
21.
Richard Essex. Man, if you weren't made...
Maybe 25.
Maybe if you weren't made for radio, too. You're perfect for podcasting. Your voice is awesome.
Well, I did radio for a long time.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense. Your voice is perfect. But today we're going to talk to you about a couple of different subjects. It's a rare interview for me to be able to get somebody of your caliber to come on my podcast to talk about what it means. I was a reporter for 10 years. I was a news reporter across the country. I definitely am not a hard news reporter. I was very much a feature reporter, but you're on the other end, and my listeners would love to hear kind of the process of a true crime or a crime reporter in this city. And you're even going to tell us a story about one of the crazier cases.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about crime is that there's no planning. When you are covering a crime story, you don't have a lot of lead time. You don't have time to go and look for different sources. You know, it's happening right now. Yeah. So in 2009, January 9th, 10th, 11th, something like that, it was brutally cold, or getting ready to be brutally cold in Indianapolis. And I was on my way to work, and it was 1:45 in the afternoon. And I literally have 1 foot out the door, 1 foot in my back door. My phone rings. Assistant news director, need you to pack for 3 days, 3 or 4 days. Where am I going? I don't know. How long am I going to be gone? I don't know. Okay, so.
Yeah, great start to your day. Okay.
So there had been a report of a plane crash in Alabama over the weekend that was connected to somebody in Indianapolis. But it had happened late on a Sunday, and we really didn't have all the information. So this is Monday, this is Monday afternoon. Everything starts to kind of come together. The plane belonged to this guy up in Fishers, Mark Schrenker. And he is a fascinating, fascinating guy. He's military trained. I don't think he was Special Forces, but he had that kind of training. Survival skills, the whole thing. Became money manager. Great life. You know, had everything that you would work for the American dream. Plane. He was a pilot. Lived at Geist. Beautiful family. Had just seemed like a perfect, ideal life. Then all of a sudden it starts coming unraveled. He takes his plane and flies down towards Pensacola, down towards Birmingham. And most people have probably heard about this. You know, he parachutes out of his plane, makes a distress call that the windshield on the plane had collapsed or had imploded. There was blood all over the cockpit. He was in trouble. Well, he sends this distress signal, which then they scrambled jets, military jets, after this thing. He parachutes out. The plane crashes 50, 75 yards from a residential area. There's no body. There's no blood. The windshield hadn't collapsed. And because it kind of hit in some, you know, softer soil, so to speak, the plane didn't explode. You know, it was pretty intact. Mm. They found maps inside the cockpit. They found a camping or campsite guide inside the cockpit that had the Florida and Alabama pages torn out. So, of course, it didn't take long to figure out whose plane it was. And prior to this happening, he had gone down to Birmingham, Alabama, taken a motorcycle, some other, you know, stuff that he needed to survive for a couple days, presumably a lot of cash or in a backpack, put it in a storage unit outside of Birmingham, Alabama. And so he parachutes out, is able to hike back to where he's got this motorcycle hidden in the storage unit, and the guy kind of vanishes. So that kind of sets the scene for where I'm going. So we go down to Louisville. We get the first flight out of Louisville to Birmingham. We travel pretty much all day, and we are live at 11 o'clock. Now, this is a little bit of inside baseball for TV, but we hadn't shot any video. We hadn't shot any interviews. We were on the ground, and we were using another station's information and their story, but we were able to get on TV at 11 o'clock live and, you know, to establish ourselves.
And when you say you use other people's information, it was possibly a sister station?
It was an affiliate. Good point. We did not take somebody else's work and claim it as our own.
Yeah, we're going to go over that in a second. But
TV stations have affiliation sharing agreements, and this was one of those where it was another station, the same affiliate that I was working for at the time, and we were able to use their information that they had gathered, and then information that we had gathered also. I mean, we weren't hitting the ground without anything. We had quite a bit of our own, but as far as local video, we were using from the Birmingham station.
So, and you're a TV station, you gotta have video. It's not like you can just go on and talk for 20 minutes about, you know, what's going on with nothing in the background and, you know, no video over your top. It's a VO is what we call it when the video plays over your voice. So, yeah, so you went down there, you're going live. Did you go live at 11?
Oh, yeah, we were live we may have been live at 10 and 11 at that time. But I remember we were certainly live at 11 o'clock.
Is this for Channel 13?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not affiliated here on this podcast. See, Richard got real nervous when I said that. No, he works at Wish TV now, but you spent how many years at 13?
10.
WTHR. 10. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah, man. We're all friends in podcasting world. There's no affiliates.
Okay. Yeah. So it was during that time period when I was down there. So the next day, and we get checked into a hotel, the next day we are kind of starting fresh. And here we are in rural Alabama. My photographer and I, of course, we'd been down to Alabama before, you know, visiting, but we'd never worked in Alabama. And it's a big difference. So, and I'd worked in the South, so I was kind of familiar with the ways of, you know, the Southern law enforcement and that type of thing. So we just start out, just see what we can find. You know, we knew that he had been at, you know, a certain hotel, and so we went out looking. Well, we come across the storage unit where he had stored his motorcycle and where he had stored things. And so,
how'd you find that?
Well, this is back before there was a lot of social media and, you know, all those things existed, but not like they do now. So back then it was just what I would call shoe leather reporting. You just get out of the car and start asking questions, and you kind of go by your instincts a little bit. When you're in a rural area and some guy shows up with a big red bright motorcycle, he's going to draw some attention. Who is this? And so we were able to find the storage unit, and the lady that owned it, she was super nice, and she showed us the whole thing and she talked about him. Well, that ends up being our story. you know, for 4, 5, and 6 that day. And going back to this affiliation sharing, we run across a big CNN crew. So we end up working out of their truck that afternoon. And because we had an affiliation or a shared agreement with CNN, we were able to share with them. They were able to share with us. So we were able to put together some pretty decent stories. So then more information starts coming out about this guy. Because at this time, he's still on the run. He's still running. The cops are looking for him. You've got FBI. You have got Alabama State Police. You've got every county cop in town. You've got Florida State Police because there was rumor that he was making his way to Florida, which is eventually where he was. So the next day, we find out that there's a sighting of him in the Panhandle area. So off we go. We are on our way down there. Now, the drive time is probably 3-4 hours, something like that. And there's still the expectation from whoever you're working for that's not a travel day. You're going to be on TV at 5 and 6. You may not have a whole lot of time to get there, but so there's an awful lot of pressure when you're on the road doing these kind of stories that you're not in familiar territory. You're going by the seat of your pants, you know, for the most part. So we make our way down to, you know, the Gulf Coast area or to the Panhandle, and find where the camping site that he'd been at, and you know, same thing. Just everybody describes the guy just perfectly. You know, he did this. You know, we were at his campsite. We talked to people that were around. We talked to people who managed the place. And the whole time, this guy is running. And nobody knows what he's going to do. You know, he has got some specialized training. And I'm not saying that he's dangerous. But, you know, the military trained him. So you don't know what you're going to run across. You don't know if you're going to run across him. And there were times, you know, we were kind of hoping, it's like, maybe we will find him before the cops do. Because that's always, you know, always one of the things that a reporter, you want to get two things before the police. You know, you want to have that story first. So we're working as fast as we can. The police working as hard as they can. And of course, they're not going to share a lot of information about this guy because he's a smart guy. You know, he's going to, everything that they say to us, he is certainly finding out about it. And so it goes 2 or 3, 4 days, and Shrinker is still on the run. We are getting to the point where it's like, okay, the guy's kind of, he's a ghost. He's gone. And we had done our stories for 5 and 6, and we had fed something back for the later shows. And we were all getting ready to come back to Indianapolis, and we're finally sitting down to have dinner one night. Phone rings.
Uh-oh.
10:15. And cops got him. So
what's 10:15 mean?
10:15 p.m. So we've got 45 minutes to find the local NBC station, drive up there. Our station had cut video, you know, and so we had to kind of write the script together. And all of a sudden, I'm standing on this hill that overlooks Birmingham, Alabama, in front of a TV camera operated by somebody I don't know, in an area I don't know, trying to relay information that we are just getting right then. I mean, it's basically rip and read. And so then the week keeps going, because now you've got to go cover, you know, where he was caught, and you find out all the different where he'd been, what he'd done, who he talked to. And it's just, when you're covering these big crime stories on the front end, it is just, you're just driven by that. Where was the guy? What was he doing? Who was he involved with? What did he do? And there's the big question that I always had in any crime story, really any story: why? Because we know the who, what, when, and where, but why did he do it? And that's always, if you don't have that curiosity on why somebody is motivated to do whatever he was accused of doing, then you're not in the right business.
I think that's why everybody listens to true crime podcasts now. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody wants an answer. Why did someone kill somebody? Why
did Tony Caritsas take somebody in and hold him hostage for a day?
Yeah, Mr. Wood. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've talked to Mr. Wood several times. Fascinating. He's a fascinating guy. And I've never, on a professional level, never done any stories with him. I have a personal connection, you know, mutual friends. And I've spent a couple of hours around him just, you know, drinking coffee and kind of listening to him. And you're
speaking about the actual hostage who's alive to this day.
Yeah, so. He's still alive, and he wrote a book a couple of years ago. I don't think he's still working. I think he's retired, but he is one of those guys that will probably always work right up until he dies.
We haven't covered it on Infamous Indy just yet, but I'm waiting for that connection to somehow get a reason to cover it. So I'm looking to you, Richard.
Well, he is one of those guys, and you know, here we're kind of going all over it, but yeah. He's one of those guys that is. He did not seek to be, obviously, in the position that he was in. He was he's a fairly private, fairly quiet man. And that incident, I don't want to say ruined his life, but it certainly marked it in ways that were impossible, almost impossible to clear up. It took a very, very heavy toll on him. And that's something that that we just don't get into a lot with in the news business.
The 24-hour cycle of news, right?
Is what do these crimes do to the people that they have been victimized by? You hear about it, that the person who's been murdered, well, you know what happened. But the families and the survivors of some of these violent crimes. And I don't blame them at all. I mean, they want to stay away from the camera. They want to stay away from they don't want to go back and relive everything. But the toll that incident took on Mr. Wood is unbelievable. I think people would be shocked. And it's amazing that he has survived as long as he has.
And literally, Richard, that's exactly why we started Infamous Indy, because I think it's unfair that people... No, we're on the same page. It's unfair that people don't get the opportunity in a long-form format to be able to explain everything and maybe go a little bit deeper, because an hour is still not long enough for a lot of these stories.
Oh, it's not. And I've made the argument in newsrooms for years. We can go out and cover these random violent crimes that happen in these neighborhoods, but if we don't put some context to why this happened, why did the suspect get in... What put them in that position to do what they just did? At what point, what was the tipping point for this person's behavior to shoot, rob, or do whatever they've done to somebody? And a lot of news organizations don't want to go into that. And I have asked those questions to the mothers of suspects. What was their turning point for your son, daughter, or whoever has just committed this crime? And almost every one of them will tell you, they saw something. It was either a group of friends or it was a life change, but they saw their child or loved one go down that path, and they were not able to stop it. And of course, a lot of these things are tied to substance abuse issues, and it's hard when you see somebody that you know go down that path. And almost every one of these violent crimes that I have covered in some way have been tied to substance abuse. And we, as an industry, don't pay enough attention to that aspect of it. And really, the country doesn't pay enough attention to that part of crime.
But flavored e-cigarettes, though. Uh-oh. Get those off the streets.
Well, the problem with those. I mean, I've got an 18-year-old that, I know he has tried, those, and I know it's the flavor, and it really, really is. For a parent, it's you can't be with him all the time, and I'm just glad he doesn't smoke.
Yeah,
but You go into any high school, and all of these kids will tell you they've tried it, they know somebody has, and even in junior highs. My 15-year-old, who is a sophomore in high school now, she said that, in, in the school that they were in, it was not uncommon for eighth graders to have those flavored jewels or whatever. So,
yeah,
I don't like government getting into everybody's business, but I mean, it's like, you know, there's comes time.
This is clearly a, because this is coming out Monday, this is clearly a current events discussion as well. So, I wanted to ask you, there's a couple of things that I know my viewers and listeners would love to hear from your perspective. I've tried to explain it, but a couple of things. First, why do police leave out, like in the Delphi case, certain information, or you don't have to use a Delphi case, or
most times, yeah,
yeah,
they're never going to tell you everything because they don't want the suspect who, if they're at large, and even if they're not, even if they're in custody, they don't want the suspects to know what they know, and you will never know everything about a case unless you go and cover the entire court hearings. And even going through the court proceedings, there's a chance you're not going to hear everything there was about that crime in the court proceedings. It takes an awful lot of work to find out exactly everything that's happened, even for a case that's been adjudicated. You know, because there are always going to be things that are suppressed in court or not discovered by detectives or police or investigators. And, you know, of course, the guilty parties are never going to offer up, you know, everything they did. I covered a horrible murder in Lexington, Kentucky a couple of years ago. These two kind of street-level drug dealers, I mean, they were, for the most part, they were college-educated kids, but they had gotten into dealing pot and found that it was a pretty lucrative business. Well, one guy got greedy, ended up killing the main guy, and stuffed him into a 55-gallon barrel and then put him in the Kentucky River. And just listening to everything that led up to that was heartbreaking for the family that's sitting there, the people that committed the crimes, the people that are affected by the crimes. It was just heartbreaking to see it because, really, these are the kids that you would grow up next to. But they just found that, you know, they can make a pretty decent living. Actually, they were making a lot of money selling weed to high school and college kids around Lexington, Kentucky. I mean, they weren't selling heroin. They weren't selling, you know, any of these. They were just selling pot to high school and college kids. And it ended up costing, really, four or five of them. It ruined their lives or killed them.
Yeah, forever.
So you know, and that's, it's kind of a warning. Everybody kind of dismisses pot as a gateway drug or whatever, and I'm not going to get into that. But just realize that even around what you would presumably think are friendly, you know, little drug dealers or pot dealers, there's a lot of violence around that, mm-hmm. An awful lot of violence.
Have you ever been close to a crime when it's happening?
Oh, yeah. I was coming home from work one night and had pulled into one of the pharmacies over here at 16th Meridian, and had gotten out, and all of a sudden this car pulls up, door opens, and this guy flops out of the car, shot 9 times. He had been shot over by Methodists, and it was, I don't know why he didn't go into the emergency room.
Yeah, Methodist is the hospital.
Yeah, and so he flops out of the car, and he's laying there bleeding, and I was on the phone with a cop friend of mine. I'm like, you should probably get on the radio and tell somebody to come here because there's a guy who's been shot. He's bleeding all over the parking lot. And then Summer Celebration, which used to be it still is a big event in Indianapolis. Several years ago, there were 10 people shot one night. 9 people in front of Steak and Shake downtown. Then a 10th one was shot on South Meridian Street. We were editing our story for the 11 o'clock news when we heard these shots fired. And my photographer stayed in the live truck to finish editing. The engineer running the truck grabbed the microphone. I grabbed the camera, and we went over on South Meridian Street to see what was going on. And as we are on South Meridian Street walking to the south, another guy is shot probably a quarter block away from us. We got to him before the police did. Mm. And then all these people running at us, we stood behind parking meters so we didn't get ran over. It was unreal. So, yeah, I've been to a couple. And I've been shot at least twice.
I didn't know that.
In Eastern Kentucky.
I'm sorry. It comes with the job. What do you think the hardest part about covering true crime, or I'm sorry, covering crime for you? It's always true. when it comes to covering crime as a reporter, what do you think the hardest and most difficult thing every time that you run into?
Well, it seems like every time that I've had issues with crime stories, it has always been family of suspects that. You know, obviously, they don't want their name, good, bad, or otherwise, spread across the news. And both times I've been either shot at or threatened with weapons have been in those situations where, you know, I was questioning somebody after a building burned down, and you know, he came at me, and the fire chief stopped him, the police chief stopped him, or he would have pounded me, if not shot me. And another.
You don't have a very punchable face. Like, I think, yeah. You look good, man. I can't believe you made it out of there.
and you know, then another drug robbery suspect in Eastern Kentucky, his brother went back in the trailer, came out with a rifle.
Oh, my gosh. Why is it important for news organizations and podcasters to cite their sources?
Well, first of all, it's ethics number one. You're stealing if you don't. If it doesn't matter what industry you're in, if you're a pharmacist or a scientist, if you are stealing somebody else's work and taking it as your own, you're stealing. So if I go and do all of this background work and I interview all these people and I put the story together, that's my work. And well, technically it belongs to the news organization that I'm working for. But it's my work product. And if you are taking it, you are taking it. You are stealing. You might as well go into my garage and take my chainsaw. And it's really, to me, it's the same thing. If you are taking something that I earned and I worked for, you are stealing.
But if you source it and you say, look, like I do on my podcast, look, we got this information. A lot of my information comes from the source. I mean, I do interviews for that purpose.
Right.
But a lot of my background information, like what I was telling everybody about this case and what we talked about earlier, is, you know, I make sure on my website there's a link to that story directly. I make sure that there's ELA citing standards for books. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all kind of, we all know, we've done it. Yeah. I did it for 10 years. I mean, if I went on the TV with a story from a guy down the street, and what if it was a competitor, I would have got fired. I would get fired immediately.
And I've seen people fired for that. I've seen some young reporters that have basically taken verbatim somebody else's story, and I've seen people that have been fired. I've seen careers ruined over that.
Now, so for what's going on in the podcasting world, there's a podcast out there that has been claimed for plagiarism, and now she decided to put a paywall behind her sources, her sources behind a paywall. So that means you have to pay to see them. What's wrong with that?
Well, that sounds to me like I can't sell your work. I mean, that's what it sounds like, that they're selling somebody else's work at a profit. I mean, that... You're kind of in the Wild West with this one.
I know. This is new territory, and a lot of people don't understand how much money she's making off other people's work. And she's been, you know, obviously taking them down. But the point is, the reason we're bringing this up, and I won't, it's the podcast Who Shall Not Be Named. That's what we're going to call that podcast. It's unfortunate because she claims to be a Crime Stopper from Indiana. She was on the board of the Crime Stoppers of Indiana, so it kind of, she has this in with police. Mm-hmm. But explain to people why that Crime Stoppers of Indiana, if you're on the board, it's not the same as being a reporter.
No, it's not. I mean, you may be privy to certain information, but you know, unless you've gone out and done the interviews and done the work, then it's not really. Now, Crime Stoppers they put some stories on their website, but I would think you would have to source that.
Yeah, well, I mean, as everything that we do is sourced. I mean, and then ultimately, you know, being able to go out and talk to people and actually do some reporting. But otherwise,
I find it very exploitative if you just tell the stories. Like you said, there's victims and families that are affected, and this changes their life forever.
Forever.
And for us to just sit there and talk about it and then get really upset and then not do anything and allow them to have a voice, that seems wrong. That's where I come from.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I can tell it makes you a little upset.
Well, it does. The things that keep me awake at night are it's not the feature stories that I've done. You know, it's these stories, and these are never you get thrown right into the middle of these stories, and it's the victims of these crimes that have kept me up at night. And there are several things that, you know, I think about every day. I mean, there are people that I think about it may be for a few seconds, but that enters my mind every single day. And yeah, you have to be respectful of those people.
Yeah. Well, it's a good lesson to learn. And your perspective is 10,000 feet, but then you go real real close, and I really appreciate it. And this is going to be interesting for the podcast. I might have to have you on. I mean, seriously, I might have to have you on again because you are such a resource, man. I have so much respect for this man.
Thank you. After he
was down the street at Channel 13, and then now he's here. He's clearly one of the best reporters we have, and clearly the experience outshines everything, even his talent. His experience outside shines his talent. But you've also become a friend of mine over the last couple of months and years.
Well, yeah, I mean, your enthusiasm. I don't like the fact that you're not in the newsroom all the time.
I
do like your enthusiasm.
Thank you very much. Yeah, the news has. I got burnt out by the news, and I wasn't doing as many true crime. God, I keep saying true crime. I had so many crime investigation or crime stories on Daybreak. It became very featurey, and then, you know, I kind of lost it because I really liked. I mean, one of the incidences I had, there was a body on the ground, and someone got shot, and the fire department is washing the blood off on the street, and it's running underneath my my shoes. I mean, that was that's going to be with me forever. And and the family is bawling, crying, screaming, why, oh my God, oh, and I have to sit there, and all of us as a reporter, I look down, and everybody from every station is standing there, and we're just in silence, and we can't say anything. So those are the experiences that I don't think people understand reporters go through, and then mentally, it affects us. Like you're saying, you think about that stuff every day, but it also negatively could affect us as well.
Well, I will, you know, I'll close with this. This would be... But this is something that I think about really almost every day. There was 2009, something like that, Hovey Street murders. There were two women and their children were shot, execution style, in a house. And if I remember correctly, somebody thought that they had drug money in there. And there had been something similar like this over on Hamilton Avenue. But it was a brutally cold night. And... the kind of night where you shouldn't be out for more than 5 or 10 minutes. You know, it was sub-zero. One of the fathers of the victims, I remember him running down Hovey Street towards the police tape. And the roads are slick. It was almost like an ice on it. And the more people walked on it, the slicker it got. And I remember this guy, he's not yelling or anything. He's just running straight at, you know, towards that house. And the cops, you know, they catch him, and he goes through the yellow tape, and he doesn't say anything, but he hits the ground, the street, and he has nothing on more than like a shirt, and he is sobbing on that ice frozen road, and everybody was just you felt horrible for, obviously, but that it's burned into my memory. I think about that at least couple times a week. And then we had an incident out there a couple of weeks ago that still brought that all back up. Now, of course, I'm just a witness to this. I'm not him. I'm not those neighbors. I'm not that family. So you can only imagine if it has that effect on us, think about the effect it's had on these families.
As the end of my podcast, I always say two things. I say thank you, and then I say everybody stay safe. So I want you to say it. Ready?
Thank you, and everybody, please stay safe, particularly you.
Thanks, Richard.
right, thank you, Richard, for joining me this week. A lot of things happening again in the podcasting world. I just want to ask you to, when you listen to podcasts, make sure you're taking what they're saying seriously. If they're not citing their sources, then there could be something wrong there. Make sure to pay attention to what they're saying. This is a very powerful tool, and we all need to use it properly and for good, just like any medium that gets out to the media or is considered media. If I make a mistake, I'll admit it, and I'll fix it right away. You can always, you know, obviously email me anything. If you think I'm messing up on something, I'm down to listen to you. And actually, I've gotten a few emails. I'm not the best at spelling, so I apologize for any spelling errors, and I'm sure I'm going to get a million of them now. But thank you to ThoughtCo.com, ABC News, and 2020. Also, Wish TV and WTHR. A lot of my information for this episode came from there. And if you'd like to see exactly where my info came from, go to infamousindie.com. And now, something completely new. Shout out Central, baby. Yeah, my first Patreon subscriber. I'm going to get her name. I'm going to try to say her name, but I got to give her a shout out. Kristen Maltry. Thank you so much for your support. She's a $5 tier member, and wow, thank you so much. She's the first one, and because she's a $5 tier member, I am giving her an official shout out. It may be longer than ones for the future, but she's my first, and there she goes. Congratulations, Kristen. Thank you so much for being a subscriber. I really, truly appreciate it. And you can also be a part of the Infamous Squad. Just head over to patreon.com/infamousindie to become a supporter. You can also follow me on Instagram at infamousindiepod and on Facebook for Infamous Indie Podcast with Joe Melillo. All right, everybody. Until next time, stay safe.